Hello. 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 And welcome. Five listeners, BD Wong, gather round. It's time for Perhaps It's You, your favorite unofficial Unsolved Mysteries rewatch podcast. Here to make the internet just a little bit worse, like everything else. This is the internet. We were just discussing how the app internet is rapidly declining, so we're here to do our part. Right, Samantha?
Right.
At the top of the show, I want to make sure that I thank listeners Amelia and Jen N, who both sent us holiday gifts. Samantha hasn't seen them yet, so I'm not going to say what they are. She doesn't get them till Saturday. She doesn't get them for a couple days. But thank you very much. It's super sweet.
The timing of our episodes didn't work out for us to thank you before the holidays, but know that you're appreciated.
Yes, we did get them. We do appreciate them. Just so everyone knows, we keep all of the stuff that you send. We have a giant shadow box right next to me as I record this.
Have you ever posted a picture of the shadow box on Instagram?
It's been a while. I should, because I
make an updated.
It's been updated.
Yeah.
There's also a shelf because the shadow box cannot contain everything anymore. And I also have a binder for like letters.
And it's not even everything because I have stuff at my house.
Right.
So it's not even everything that we have been sent by our lovely listeners.
So just know.
Or any of the stuff we've eaten. I mean.
Yeah, there's been a lot of that. Baby's first mead. Who remembers baby's first mead? So even if you didn't get the shout out and appreciation that you really deserved for your, like, a lot of these presents are handmade and I'm sure took a lot of time. Just know that we do appreciate them. We keep them around. We gaze upon their beauty. We love them. We feel loved. That's why we keep making this stupid thing. Because otherwise, like, I said something to Mac. I don't even know what. It was like, oh, I got to sit down and take notes on this because, you know, I'm such a baby. And Mac was sort of like, well, you got to finish it at this point.
Is this like the sunk cost fallacy? Like,
I think so.
We've put so much time, energy, resources into this thing that now we have to get to the season.
Yeah, he was like, well, you just got to do the whole show.
It's
going to
take us like a decade at this point. I mean, we do an episode every other week. But we take so many breaks, so many hiatuses. Like, we're going to be dead before we can finish this thing.
Too bad you're stuck talking to me for that whole time.
Damn.
But when he said that, I was sort of like, oh, wow, I guess you're right. I hadn't even really thought, because everybody's always like, what are you going to do when you run out of mysteries? And I'm like, oh, my God, that's never going to happen.
We're going to be done with this podcast finally is what we're going to do.
And I've like been like, oh, maybe we'll do like, you know, more like Patreon content. We'll just talk about random stuff. But it's just like, let's just try to get through this. What are you talking about? Samantha immediately, nope. We will be done. I will hang up my podcasting hat. What are you talking about? Too funny. Okay. So we are on. Do we have any updates? I really don't.
No. I was trying to think if I had any flag updates, but I really don't think I do. We talked about them all on our last episode. So
we have a flag now, and it's better. And I don't know if any racist losers got the seal tattooed on their cheek like I suggested, so we know who they are, but I hope they're considering that.
They have their appointments booked.
Yeah, and you know what? Particularly in the Twin Cities, like I feel like tattoos artists are booked out. So it might take a while.
This time next year we'll see them everywhere.
And then we'll go, ugh, I'm avoiding you. I was going to come up with like some stereotypical name. And I don't even know what that would be.
Chad.
Like, I don't know. Yeah. Bubba or something. Are people in Minnesota named Bubba? I don't think so. I've yet to meet a Bubba.
I don't know. Are you telling me to hang out in places where Bubbas would hang out?
Look, maybe me and a Bubba could get along, but it's yet to happen. I've never dated a Bubba. I don't think I've ever met a Bubba. You know, Bubbas, are you listening? Get in touch.
Get in touch.
Perhaps It's You podcast, gmail.com. Justice for Bubbas. Let us know what's up with you. Where do you live? What are you into?
What injustice has been perpetrated against Bubbas?
Yeah. How do you feel about the new Minnesota flag?
I think we know.
Hey, I'm trying not to judge. I'm trying to open a dialogue. You're like, we know. Samantha's not, just me. Just open a dialogue with me. Samantha's busy. Well, look, we somehow made it to season 8, episode 10, without learning one thing about podcasting and learning very little about Unsolved Mysteries. And I think that's a remarkable achievement.
So do I.
Particularly for a podcast in the top 1% of podcasts worldwide. Ha! They said it couldn't be done. And they should have been right. But they were wrong. Samantha, you start off this week.
Yeah, we got another mystery-packed episode. So this is a, I'm not going to say local, because it's from northern Minnesota, but we got a Minnesota mystery.
I did appreciate that we, there's a meme that's just like, Minnesota mentioned, and like someone's really excited, because, I don't know, Minnesota doesn't come up that often, unless you listen to this podcast. But I was like, oh, yay, even though it's about a woman almost freezing to death, so.
In a city of in Minnesota I've never heard of. No, this is a, I'm not even, is this, this is a, this is a paranormal or a PsyMed? I don't
think,
fucking know.
I think it's a miracle.
A miracle. Okay. Yeah, you're right. This is the power of prayer. This is the Ice Woman. So,
bold. That's fucking
what they called it.
I know. I'm just saying, I'm not saying you're being bold. I'm saying it's bold to call this woman like, oh, look, I'm glad she's fine.
Okay, if she in real life looked like she did in the reenactment, she is Ice Woman.
Okay,
that's fair. Looked like she was carved out of an ice cube in the reenactment. I really,
watching it out loud, went, oh my god.
So did I!
Because, yeah, it's like an ice sculpture.
Shocking.
Okay, I'm sorry. I interrupted. Go on.
December 20th, 1980. A bitterly cold morning in Langby, Minnesota. Somewhere up north. I have no idea where this is. A man opened his back door to find his 19-year-old neighbor, Jean Hillard, laying in the snow. She was literally frozen solid, is what Robert Stack says.
That is such a fucking night. I was thinking about this. Like, say I was expecting you to come over. We have to record or something. Mm-hmm. You're forced to see me. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you just, like, never show up. And I'm, like, texting you. I'm calling you. I can't get a hold of you. I'm like, oh, damn, what happened to Samantha? And then eventually I, like, open my door and I find you frozen solid.
It's just, oh my, like, God. Jack Frost breathed on me. That's what I look like. I'm just, like, at your, yes, back door. Frozen in the act of reaching for your doorknob.
Yes! You're like a statue. Like, I'm like, oh, I don't know where Samantha is, but I gotta let my dogs out. They're whining and being annoying. And I go to open the door. And then, yeah, there's you as a statue trying to get in my house. Literally, your lips are open because you're trying to go, Liz, help me. But it froze. Oh, no.
It is.
I hate it.
It is actually a nightmare. And the reenactment, I mean, honestly, you have to watch it. It's shocking.
It will make you take hypothermia very seriously, yes, is what I'm going to say.
So the night before, Jean's car had ran off the road and gotten stuck. Jean was trying desperately to reach her neighbor's house. The temperature was 25 degrees below zero. She tells us that she was worried about carbon monoxide poisoning, which is something you should be concerned about if you are stranded in the winter. But I think you just have to make sure that your, like, tailpipe is clear. I think you can stay in your car. I don't think you need to, like, go out. She had, like, no coat on. She was not dressed for the temperatures.
She was being very brazen about it, which she was just like, I've always lived where it's cold. Who cares? She, like, didn't even think about it.
It was very Minnesotan, I would say.
She was just like, cold. Who gives a fuck? And it's like, well, that does literally kill people.
But, I mean, this seems like a remote area. She obviously didn't have a cell phone. This was 1980. I'm not sure that she, like, had a lot of other options. So, you know, I probably would have done the same thing in her position.
Yeah, I think I would have tried to make it, too. That's maybe not the smartest move. Also, I think we've talked about this before. And, like, everything, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But I feel like carbon monoxide poisoning and cars used to be more of a problem than it is today. I feel like today you could probably stay in your car and it would be fine. But I do think it used to be, there's some other case where we talked about this, where someone got,
yeah, that
carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah, I know, you just, like, if you go off the road into a ditch, you just, like, you have to dig out your tailpipe and then make sure that periodically you check it, I think, to make sure it's not, like, getting frozen over or, like, there's not snow in it. I think that's, like, do not take my word for it. Google it next time you're stuck in a ditch. But, yeah, I think you don't need to, like, immediately evacuate your car just because it's freezing. Although if your car's like dead and there's the heat doesn't work, I mean, I'm sure there's, you should probably have like a first aid kit or something in your car. I don't know. Living in Minnesota my entire life, do I have literally anything in my car that would help me in an emergency?
No.
Of course not. Do I have one of those emergency blankets? No.
I'm looking at Snopes right now for a fat check, and it says, can you get carbon monoxide poisoning from sitting in a snowed-in car? And it says, be sure to clear the exhaust pipe before running your car after a snowstorm. Okay. So you were correct.
There you go. So she could have stayed in her car. Although, you know, would anyone have come around to get her before she ran out of gas? Maybe not. So she, at any rate, decided she knew where her neighbor was. She was going to try and walk to her neighbor's house. But it was freezing that night, and she was not dressed for the weather. Her neighbor, upon finding her, this was Dorothy Killian, who was the nurse at the local hospital she was brought to, said that she was so cold, it was like reaching into a freezer and picking out a frozen stick of wood. Her face was
so disturbing.
I know. Her face was white. They said
also, who's reaching into a freezer and picking out a frozen stick of wood? A
weird analogy. I feel like frozen meat would have made more sense. I don't know why you have. Maybe it's a northern Minnesota thing. I do not know.
She's like, oh, good. The firewood's ready. Put it in the freezer.
Maybe it's because she was so stiff. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just being a jerk. It does paint a picture.
So she wasn't dead, but it seems like she was close to dead. They hooked her up to a monitor and they got like one heartbeat, like literally just one. But after like sitting there for a minute, they suddenly got two heartbeats. But then they thought it was kind of like almost like a death rhythm. Like her heart was like not beating consistently or whatever. We hear from a Dr. Ryan Kelly, who is called in. And says that she was severely frostbitten. None of her limbs would bend or move. And Dr. Ryan Kelly is quoted as saying, things looked grim.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, Doc.
So we're explained a little bit about like what frostbite means, hypothermia means.
I hated learning this.
So ice crystals literally form in the cells. And in doing so, they destroy those cells that they're inside of.
I guess on some level, I knew this and I was probably taught this at some point. I don't know. But it just painted such a picture for me that's very gross to me.
It's disturbing. I mean, it makes sense why your limbs like turn black, you know, because your cells literally are dying as the ice crystals are forming in them. So he says that the other thing that happens as your internal organs begin to cool, it becomes harder and harder for them to function until they eventually just stop. And at that point, the patient is very likely to die. So she was getting close to this point where her organs would soon shut down. If not, like they could have even been in the process of shutting down.
We shouldn't live here. That's the last time.
I mean, really, it's a very inhospitable place. So we hear from Rosie Erickson, who was a worker in the hospital, who was worried that no matter, like, despite the fact that they were trying their best, that it wouldn't ultimately be enough. And Robert Stack is quoted as saying she knew that Jean needed a miracle. So she is the one that called the pastor of her church and stated simply that Jean Hillard from the Langby area was brought into the hospital in a frozen condition, very critical, and she needs prayer.
Okay.
Apparently they got the blessing of the family. I assume like the family was there. They asked if they could like put out a prayer chain. And that started at 9 a.m. that morning. Within 10 minutes, we're told that more than 30 people were praying for Jean.
That doesn't seem like that many.
Apparently it was enough to get God's attention.
Is that rude of me to be like, that's your whole church?
It might be half the town. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. That might be all the people they've ever met. That's like their whole graduating class. I don't know.
What is the population of Langby, Minnesota?
Let's see. Oh. Guess what the population was for the 2021 census.
490. It literally is half the population.
Yeah.
I did not see that coming.
I'm like, couldn't they get more people? We're talking about a third of the fucking town. Wow. Okay. Also, if you Google Langby, Minnesota, this story is the third thing that comes
up. Yeah, of course it is. What else has ever happened in Langby, Minnesota?
90 people. Oh my God.
That is so funny. Okay.
If anybody is from Langby, Minnesota, oh my God, please write in. If you're one of the 90, be part of the 5.
Listen to this podcast.
PrepstitutePodcast@gmail.com.
Incredible. So, well, it may not have seemed like a lot of people. Half the town was praying for Jean.
Oh my God. Oh, I don't know why I'm laughing. It's just like, you know how when you talk about a small town, it's like either a stop sign town or a stop light town?
This might not even have either.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. This is like, they're like a stop sign. Whoa, whoa, whoa. La-di-da. We don't have everything in Langby.
We don't have your fancy schmancy.
Yeah. You go back to the cities with that kind of talk.
So the odds against Jean were obviously enormous. However, 2 hours later, she suddenly went into violent convulsions. Which sounds bad, but it was actually a good sign. The danger was far from over, however. Doctors worried that even if Jean regained consciousness, she might have serious brain damage. And the frostbite was so severe that amputating Jean's legs seemed inevitable. Ugh. But just when they were expecting the worst, Jean suddenly regained consciousness. She said that she woke up in the hospital around noon and that things were kind of hazy and people were asking her questions. And if the Unsolved Mysteries reenactment is correct, the doctor was literally saying, how many fingers am I holding up? So if you've ever, if you wear glasses, everyone who's ever done that to you, that's the experience that Jean had waking up from a coma.
I also like that she was like, 4, what is wrong with you? Why are you giving me this stupid test? Yes, I know what day it is. Hello.
So she couldn't figure out why they were talking to her that way or why they were treating her.
She was like, you know, I'm not a child. I can count fingers.
Yeah. They were like, you know, who are you? What year it is? And she was like, of course I know who I am. What's the big deal? So that's like how immediately she was.
Girl, you were like a piece of wood put in a freezer. A thing that is not said about many people.
So we hear from her sister, who says that it was not only it was obviously a relief when she came to, but the most miraculous thing was that her legs made a full recovery. She didn't have like any lasting damage. She didn't have to have any amputations. The frostbite seemed to clear up no problem. In fact, like they described the black of the frostbite sort of like disappearing, like little by little. I don't know.
They could almost like see it dissipating.
Yeah.
Like they kept lifting up the blanket to look at her legs and there would be a little bit less and a little bit less. Like,
right.
There was like visual progress of her legs healing, which is weird.
Yep. So anyway, I guess the mystery is, did the power of prayer heal Jean? She says, okay, at the very end, she says, I'm happy for Jean, but I really take issue with the sentiment. So here's the quote. So Robert Sachs says Jean credits her survival and astonishing recovery not only to the doctors and nurses who cared for her, but also the friends and neighbors who prayed for her. And this is her quote. Quote, there are other people across the nation that same night that were found in the same condition I was, and they died. I just think that without all these people, I may not have survived.
Yeah,
so fuck them, I guess. I'm like, what?
Yeah, fuck them, I guess.
Fuck those people. God didn't care about them. I don't know.
They didn't get a third of their town praying for them, Samantha. That was their downfall. God was like, I'm busy saving Jean, okay? She put in the community outreach. The rest of y'all, I don't know what's going to happen to you. I guess.
Like, we've had mysteries like this before about the power of prayer, and we've said it before. But, like, just the thought that God's up there being like, no one cares about you fuckers. You can die. Like,
it's
Jean has 30 people praying for her, so I'm going to save her instead.
Yeah, I that's not a God I would personally want to believe in, but to each their own, I suppose. I mean, that's wild and great for her. And I don't know, maybe she'll put a stop sign in town. Jean, please put some warmer things in. Do you think she has like now like a bunch of emergency shit in her car, or do you think she's like, that won't happen again?
I don't know. At the end, we find out that she does still live in Minnesota. Actually, I should look up the Unsolved Mysteries wiki. I assume that she has an emergency kit in her car. She probably has a cell phone at this point.
Or do you think she's like, what are the odds?
That happens again.
Yeah.
That's my girl math. That's what I would probably say.
I'm probably fine. I won't learn anything from this.
Yeah, I mean, now that I know there's only 90 people in that town, I kind of understand why she tried to walk to her neighbor's house. Like, no one was coming to find her.
No one is going to come by.
Oh, there's not no like updates just... in the Unsolved Mysteries wiki.
Wait, we didn't find out if the power of prayer is real?
And it says results unsolved, so no.
I love that for every miracle segment. Sorry, the Pope didn't weigh in on this one. We don't know. All right, it's my turn to talk about a story from Boston. And this is my new hated mystery. Because it just made me really, really sad.
So, yeah, this one sucks. I mean,
this one sucks.
Just the story itself fucking is horrible.
It made me cry. It's just, you know what? The world is a terrible place sometimes. So this takes place in Boston. In the airline industry, Robert Stack tells us that 27-year-old Stu Taraskowitz, I think. Okay, she lived in Saugus, Massachusetts. And so she was something of a trailblazer in the airline industry. In 1989, she became only the second woman hired by Northwest Airlines as a ground services employee at the ramp at Boston's Logan Airport. So her job originally included loading and unloading baggage and de-icing planes, which is like really hard manual labor. But that was the kind of challenge that she thrived on, according to her mother, Marlene. She loved being on the ramp and doing her job. And she would often joke like, oh, I moved a million bags today and stuff like that. So she never complained about the job to her mom. She worked her way up from cleaning the interiors of jets to eventually getting a new job where she was promoted in 1992 to being the ramp supervisor. And she was the first woman to ever hold that position. It's crazy to me. Like, this is fucking 1992. This is in my lifetime. And this is the first time a woman ever had that job. Isn't that crazy?
That's wild. And, you know, all these misogynists she worked with being pissed that she got, like, a man's job or whatever. Like, she worked hard. She started at the bottom, literally, and worked her way up.
It's not good enough. Also,
no, it never would have been, but like, it's just ridiculous.
I also feel like misogynists in general all the time are like, oh, well, men have to do all the hard jobs and women just get to, quote, stay home, which guess what? Most women do not get to do that. But also, it's like, who decided that men are doing all the labor intensive jobs?
Right.
You motherfuckers decided that. Women did decide that. And you're actively keeping women out of those positions.
So yeah, it's very just frustrating. Like it's new.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. So on the morning of September 14th, 1992, around 7:30 a.m., her blue Toyota Tercel was discovered in front of the Bravo Auto and Tire Service Company, which is not far from the airport in the Boston area. Blood was found next to it and on the trunk, so someone called it in, and sadly, Sue's body was found inside the trunk. She had been bludgeoned and stabbed multiple times. The police believe she was killed somewhere else and then driven to the auto shop. It's worth noting that she was not robbed and she was not sexually assaulted. So those were not motives for the crime. Her family assumed that she had just been targeted at random, you know, that it was just like a sad tragedy. And then at Christmas time, like a year later, in 93, her mom finally ventured into Sue's room after not, you know, it's just like too hard to go in there that whole time. But she was like, oh, I want to put out something that was special to Sue for the holidays. So she starts looking around the room and she finds this briefcase that she was not familiar with. And inside that briefcase, Sue kept a diary. And in that diary, she documented accounts of sexual harassment that she endured at her job that she had never mentioned to her family. Like, she really put on a brave face for them. And I think was trying to spare them what she was going through, because I'm sure they would have wanted her to quit.
Oh,
and 100%. like you would anybody that was going through this, because it's very persistent and it's very horrendous. So this is the first time that her mom had heard about any of this. The journal included quotes of graffiti, which Unsolved Mysteries describes as insulting, demeaning, and lurid, that had been etched in men's rooms at the airport, but even in the cargo holds of planes. People are gross. They write gross graffiti in bathrooms. But obviously, she's not going to see that, right? She is not going into the men's bathroom. So they have to do it to the cargo holds of planes so she'll actually see it. It's like, how do you have that much time at your job that you're like carving shit into metal or whatever
seriously
to deface you know, also like very expensive company property. Her mom was unaware that her coworkers were so shitty, and she wondered if the harassment was the reason Sue had been murdered, and that brought like a new level to the case. In numerous passages, Sue described what appeared to be blatant acts of hostility, is what Robert Stack calls it. Here's one diary entry that is supposedly typical. On April 12th, 1989, Bobby, who I think I learned this from Unsolved Mysteries Wiki, but she like very briefly dated this guy, Bobby. And I don't think he took them not dating anymore very well. So he's just like a total dick.
Oh, okay. That's an element I didn't realize.
That was on the Unsolved Mysteries Wiki. And I don't know what the source for that is. Right. I don't know where the information came from, but there are actually
through the radio.
Yes.
Okay, so that makes a lot. I mean, it makes a little bit more sense if he was like a jilted ex or whatever. He seems wildly absurd, like out of nowhere in the episode.
Yes, because what he does is like they're in the break room. Sue is playing her radio, so they can listen to music, and Bobby just walks in, picks up the radio, and like throws it and smashes it.
Like, why? You're watching the episode, like. What?
Like something a bully in a TV show would do. Not even like a real bully. You know what I mean? Like not even like a real school bully would be like this blatant to just like walk in. Everyone is listening to music for one thing, not just her. And he like picks up her radio and smashes it. And everybody's like, what the fuck? And he's like, oh, the Bruins lost. And she's like, okay. So that her and her coworkers like put the radio back together, plug it back in. It still works. He comes and smashes it again.
What's wild about this is that you know that he and all the other misogynists at her work that hated her were like, you know, women are too emotional for jobs like this.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And he's like smashing radios supposedly because the Bruins lost, but really because he can't get pussy anymore. So it's like, Bobby, oh, check yourself. Oh my god. So she did have a new boyfriend at the time, and he apparently spoke to Bobby and was like, well, you have to replace the radio. You can't just go around smashing people's stuff. And he refused. So Sue confronted him later and was like, look, Bobby, my mom gave me that radio for Christmas. Like, you have to buy me a new one. And he was like, what are you going to do? Send your punk boyfriend over here? Is he going to beat me up? He's lucky I didn't kill him.
This man needs to take a moment.
I also feel like, I don't know, in 89, radios can be kind of expensive. That's like a nice gift, you know?
It sure was, yeah.
And it's like, too bad. I wanted to break it. Okay, so anyway, she filed numerous formal complaints with the management of Northwest Airlines and with her union, but surprise, surprise, little was done to curb the harassment. Stuff like this was happening constantly. That radio thing is just like one example. So in time, the abuse escalated, and the like anonymous graffiti was like getting more targeted, and it would be literally labeled Sue T. And then we hear from Laura Brown, who is the reporter for the Boston Herald. And she's like, look, this isn't like a couple cases of graffiti that can just be washed away. This is like repeated harassment, targeted harassment. And that the graffiti like escalates to death threats.
We like see inside her own locker.
Yeah, we see. I think this comes up a little later, but we see her open her locker and someone has drawn a coffin with her name on it. Okay, so she also mentioned in her diary that she was getting anonymous calls at all hours of the night. She recorded some of the times that the calls happened, and in one instance a caller said, get off our backs, Sue T, baby. Which I don't know why he's talking like Ken. That's really annoying. Okay. Sue T, baby. When she asked who was calling, the caller would not respond. There was also instances where her car was vandalized, her boyfriend's car was vandalized, and also coworkers who were supporting her, their cars would be vandalized. Curiously, Sue's diary only covered the first 8.5 months at her new job, but from talking to like our other coworkers, it sounds like the harassment got even worse. I wonder if she just kind of gave up recording it.
Well, it must have been so lonely. Like, she hasn't been able to tell anyone in her family. She kind of confided in her friends, but it seems like they didn't really understand the extent of it.
Yeah, I wonder if it's because people would have told her to quit. Yeah. And she clearly wanted to stay and not let them win. And I think also maybe her coworkers didn't even know the extent of what was going on, because if they sided with her, they would also get harassed. So yeah. She's like trying to protect them too.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay, in 92, she was promoted to ramp supervisor, and she was put in charge of employees that she once worked at the tarmac, and that did not go over well. She was originally passed up for this promotion, even though she was next in line, by a man who made an illegal bid for the job. So she filed a grievance and won, and that's how she became the first woman to hold the position. But of course, because
sure, that made them happy.
Yeah, exactly. Because people are fucking assholes. That wasn't okay. So we hear from one of Sue's coworkers that actually seemed cool. His name was Joseph Snow. He has a mustache that has a very like old school hip hop vibe to me. I think Sir Mix-a-Lot used to have this kind of mustache where it's like it comes over the lip and it's like very thin. He's like grooming it to keep it like very thin, not brushy at all. So that is called hands in the air.
Okay.
So according to Joseph Snow, a lot of his co-workers didn't want a woman to be their boss because, like you said, they thought that was a man's job. But that didn't stop her, according to Joseph, for standing up for coming to work and standing up for things that thought that she thought were wrong, because she was trying to make the industry like better and like less of a white boys club. Right.
Right.
We also hear from another coworker, Deborah, which I think is like one of the very few female coworkers that she had, saying that, you know, men were resenting her having a position of authority and now that she was being their boss. But Sue was always very conscientious about her job and was trying to make it a better place. And she wanted, you know, women to be able to get jobs there and people of color to be able to get jobs there. And yeah, it was not appreciated. So a few months after her promotion, the graffiti was getting more sinister. That's when she found that coffin drawing that I talked about. On another occasion, Sue and Deborah, her other female coworker, had a meeting at Northwest that did not go well. They don't say why, but during the meeting, Sue started to cry. And then she was crying so hard that she couldn't control herself. And then she was, you know, very embarrassed. And so she continued crying and she went into the women's room. And when Deborah went to console her, she found her sobbing and she was like, I broke our one rule. I can't believe I started crying. But also, like, this level of harassment and no one is taking it seriously.
For such an extended period of time, too.
Yeah. And so she's crying and she's super embarrassed and she feels like she's let her friend down by being, like, quote unquote, too emotional for the job. But she told Deborah at that time that she was afraid. And Deborah, in retrospect, is wondering if she meant, like, literally afraid for her life. Yeah. Or just, you know, it's hard to say. Okay, anyway, this is a part of what sucks, is that she was trying to do something nice, even in her, like, last moments. During the graveyard shift from 11 to p.m. to 7 a.m. on September 12th, 1992, Sue volunteered to go to a restaurant to pick up sandwiches for her crew. That's not something that she needed to do, but she wanted to, like, make sure that her crew, which I'm sure most of them are shitty, she's like still trying to take care of them. So she left around 1 a.m. on September 13th and never returned. No one reported her missing for a day and a half.
This is the part that's so suspicious to me.
It's very frustrating. I have to assume that the couple coworkers we hear from that are not dicks were not working that night, because I feel like they would have been like, what the fuck? Her mom thought she was working overtime when she didn't come home. So she learned that she didn't show up to work on the 14th. Her mom reports her missing. That's when that's when she learns that Sue's dead, that they find her body when she goes to report her missing. Ugh. Her body was found. The money she was going to use to buy the sandwiches was with her, indicating that she never made it to the restaurant. Incredibly, instead of reporting her missing, Sue's coworkers marked her time card to indicate that she returned and left at the end of her shift and even returned the next day. And when they were asked about this, they said that they were covering for her, but her mom doesn't believe them because she asked, well, has she ever done this before? Has she ever just like skipped out on work and you had to cover for her? And they were like, well, no, actually, she's like super responsible.
So why did you call someone?
So why wouldn't you be concerned that she never came back? And you never got your sandwiches. Like, also, these people all seem like such babies. They would have freaked out if they didn't get their fucking sandwiches. Where's my sandwiches, right? hard to believe that they were just like, oh, we'll just, this person that we hate and we're trying to actively get her to leave her job, let's just punch in and out for her so no one notices that she's missing.
Yeah.
So it does make it seem like there's a cover-up involved. Authorities now believe that Sue's death may have been connected to a federal investigation of Northwest that took place in the summer of 92. What it turns out is that some of the baggage handlers at the same facility were operating a stolen credit card ring. So what would happen is shipments of brand new credit cards would come in on these Northwest jets. Groups of co-workers were stealing them, using them, and then selling them. And this scam netted over $7 million. 10 Northwest employees were eventually indicted and given various sentences. To Marlene, Sue's mom, some of the names on this the indictment, by the time it makes it to the news, are very familiar because they're names from Sue's diary of people who were harassing her.
Mm.
So Marlene believes that Sue was actually set up by her coworkers and that for whatever reason, they were afraid that Sue was going to squeal about something. So, okay, obviously, Sue is a good employee. She's by the book. She's trying to do the right thing. I don't know if they were always harassing her because they didn't want her working there and finding out they were stealing credit cards, or they were already harassing her. And then they're like, well, there's no way Sue's not going to rat us out. She fucking hates us now because we've made her life miserable.
Yeah.
But either way, they knew that she wouldn't go along with this credit card stealing ring. And so they were trying to, like, force her out of the job. Guess what? Northwest Airlines declined to be interviewed by the, for the story. At this point, shocking. They don't exist. They got bought out by Delta a long time ago. The authorities are currently investigating more than one suspect, but lack the evidence to press charges. Each year on the anniversary of her death, her family holds a candlelight vigil at the spot where her body is found. And then we hear from her mom asking, if you know about this murder, how can you just, like, go around carrying this guilt? Okay, part of what made this a big story is that in 1995, Sue's family sued Northwest for sexual harassment because they did not do their legal duties to make it a safe work environment. The party's letter reached a settlement, which included a payout of $75,000 to her estate and a promise of $250,000 reward for anyone that comes with information that leads to an arrest and conviction. Obviously, they denied any wrongdoing, but that settlement was the largest discrimination settlement ever granted in Massachusetts at that time.
Wow.
Okay. Let's see here. So according to Unsolved Mysteries Wiki, her mom believes that Sue was killed by someone she knew. She thinks the sandwich run thing was kind of a setup to get her to go somewhere and then be killed. She was found by the Esquire Club, which is a bar frequented by airline employees. Whether or not that's connected is unknown. Basically, she had the two shittiest co-workers were Joseph Nuzzo and this Bobby Brooks guy. And this is where it says that her and Brooks had been briefly romantically involved, and she had several problems with both of them. She had once tried to break up a fist fight between Nuzzo and two other employees.
Oh my god, what is wrong with these dudes?
I don't know. They seem like they are...
Grow up!
Full of roid rage or something? Like, why are you acting like this? Why are you getting into fist fights at work? Anyway, so they fired him, but only for 6 months. Which is not how firing works, Northwest Airlines. So when he was pissed, and... and of course blamed Sue for him fist fighting at work. So during the time that he was out of work for 6 months, he keyed her car, slashed her tires, stalked her house, made anonymous telephone calls, and told others, including Bobby Brooks, that he would, quote, exact revenge.
For what? Don't fist fight people at work.
Yeah, that's generally frowned upon. Unless you are
her fault.
A boxer, you should not be punching people at work.
Also, you got your job back. Like, you should consider yourself lucky.
Yes. Oh, my God. You committed assault. There's more information about this. But basically, is it Brooks? Is it this Nuzzo guy? Is it both of them? Like, there really isn't it seems like it's one of them. But there's really not any evidence. Mm-hmm. And Mac was like, how do you kill someone, put them in a trunk of a car, and not leave any evidence? But...
maybe it was we don't hear a lot about the investigation. Maybe it was
we
not,
really don't.
Maybe it was and a shitty investigation.
I wouldn't be too surprised if these are the type of dicks who know people who are cops. This is fucking Boston.
Sure.
There's like Nuzo told someone that he believed Sue was a rat. 1 week later, he was fired. A few weeks after his firing, Sue was murdered. There's more stuff about the credit card scheme, blah, blah, blah. People went to jail for that, but nobody has gone. It's still unsolved. Nobody has gone to jail for Sue's murder. And also, I found this like. Okay, so Sue was like a known lover of the comic strip Peanuts. And this made enough news that after her death, Charles Schulz made a drawing of Snoopy that was added to her gravestone.
Oh.
Fucking Sue, I'm so sorry.
I feel so bad for Sue.
All she was trying to do was do her fucking job and make her workplace better. And this is what she got.
Yeah.
Like, I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And both Sue's father and brother have passed away. And Delta Airlines is apparently standing by their the original commitment Northwest had for that $250,000 reward. So maybe someone will eventually come forward. I don't know.
I hope so. This is one I would love to see solved.
Yes, because it's this poor woman.
I wish we knew more about the investigation, because we've been watching a lot of Cold Case Files. And basically, if you've watched any recent episodes of Cold Case Files, they're all solved by ancestry DNA. Like, yeah. All of that, like every single episode. It's almost like a formula at this point. And we have a joke where, like, they don't need to explain how it works to us anymore, because every episode, there's this new technology and you get the whole rundown. It's like, yeah, this is episode 12. Like, we know. But like,
well, there is a Dateline about this case, so maybe that would have more information. It was also featured on both Trace Evidence and the Trail Went Cold podcasts.
Okay. Because, like, I don't know, maybe there's some DNA and they could do the ancestry stuff and figure out.
Yeah. We don't hear anything about the investigation, actually. And now that you mention that, that's kind of suspicious.
Yeah. Maybe there's not a lot to tell.
Like, did they properly process that car? Did they look for DNA and shit?
Right. Poor Sue. I might watch that Dateline.
You should, because I want to know too. I should watch it too.
Okay. We have.
Just for Sue.
I know. Okay. We have. I think this is an unexplained death. So this is the case of Matt Flores. Matt and Denise, according to Robert Stack, had it all. A loving marriage, a beautiful daughter, dreams of a full, happy life. Dreams that sadly vanished in an instant when Matt Flores was gunned down in cold blood at just 26 years old.
How come none of these stories are they had it all? And it continued to be great.
And they lived happily ever after.
And then they found the magic rock. The
greatest mystery of all.
How are these people so happy? Let's investigate.
So Matt, who was a very handsome man, married Denise LePage. Their friends called it the wedding of the century. He was a second lieutenant in the Army and later served with honor in Operation Desert Storm. Once Matt came home to Fort Stewart, Georgia, he and Denise started a family. In July 1993, their daughter Danielle was born. 8 months later, Matt began a promising career with a computer company based in California's Silicon Valley. According to Denise, he traveled there for a brief training program. This was at the start of their like new family. They were making decisions instead of the military. It was his dream come true.
This is when like their life is like, this is supposed to be the salad days. Like their life is supposed to like really hit its stride right about now.
And
like,
his life, he sort of felt like dreams was just beginning.
Yeah.
Because up until this point, he was at the whim of the military. He really couldn't make his own decisions. He's now out of the military. He has a new family. He's getting this job and making all of his own choices. It just felt like, you know, and then he had landed this job, which he described as his dream job. Everything seemed like it was going perfect for Matt. March 24, 1994 rolled around. It was his ninth day of training for his new job. That morning, he arrived at work and parked in the middle of the lot. Nearby, another employee sat listening to a talk show on her car radio. Because this was when, if you were really into the show you were listening to, you had to finish it in your car because you didn't have a phone. You could stream it on. Kids, Arden, you don't remember those days.
Exactly.
Suddenly gunshots rang out. She moved to investigate, and according to Sergeant George Teal of the Santa Clara Police Department, the female witness called 911 after realizing someone had been shot. So about four or five officers responded immediately. Paramedics and fire also responded. Unfortunately, though, they were not able to revive Matt, who was pronounced dead at the scene. He had been shot once in the back
not
of the head.
Not enough prayers, I guess, Matt. Should have gotten a third of the town to pray for you.
It probably would have been a little harder in
anywhere else.
Santa Clara.
Literally any other town.
He had been shot once in the back of the head at point blank range. He probably never even saw his killer. Incredibly, no one else saw either, even though there were more than 20 people in the parking lot at the time.
Oh my God.
Matt's mother, Ellen Morrow, was dumbfounded as to why someone would want to kill her son. He had no enemies. He wasn't involved in anything nefarious. There's just nothing to indicate, like, who would want him dead. Almost immediately, the investigation was hampered by a terrible piece of bad luck. Despite the presence of several security cameras in the parking lot, the killing itself took place in a blind spot just out of view of any camera. One of the cameras, however, did give Sergeant Teal his most significant lead. So about 20 minutes before the shooting, there was a two-door sport model Ford Explorer that came into the parking lot and parked in one of the stalls facing directly to the camera lens. A few seconds later, a two-door white Ford Probe came, I don't know anything about cars, came in the same lane that Matt would take later. The Explorer backed out, followed by the white car. The Ford Probe could look something like Matt's rental, which was a white Chevy Corsica. About 4 minutes before the shooting, we see the same Explorer exiting the parking lot. And then about 3 minutes before the shooting, the vehicle came back into the parking lot and went in the direction where the shooting occurred. So the theory here is that Matt was mistaken for someone else because he had a very similar car as this other car that was the Ford Explorer seemed like it was like kind of following that car.
If you're going to kill people in parking lots, unlike Samantha and I, you need to know about cars, okay?
You do, because otherwise, the difference between a Ford Probe and a Chevy Corsica,
cars that they have not made in decades, because otherwise you're going to shoot the wrong person.
Yeah, which honestly, a case of mistaken identity makes a lot of sense, because who would want this man dead?
Yeah, and obviously a lot of people are like, I have no skeletons in my closet, but they looked into it, and it seems like this guy was squeaky clean.
Squeaky, so. Yeah. So at 8:12 a.m., 2 minutes before the shooting, two cars entered the lot. One was driven by the female witness. The other was Matt Flores. At 8:15, the murder took place just out of camera range. According to Sergeant Teal, 20 seconds later, the Ford Explorer was seen leaving the parking lot for the last time. So it's suspicious, and they want to know who was in this Ford Explorer. Because the Explorer initially followed a car that looked like Matt's, Sergeant Teal believes that the murderer may have been a case of mistaken identity.
This is not the first time we've talked about this, that someone shoots someone because they have the same car or a similar car.
Yeah. You should be... Look, murderers, listen up.
Do your homework, murderers.
Make sure you're killing the right person. Oh, God. Don't isolate that audio.
Well, I don't think Repod exists anymore, so you're safe.
Fair enough. Poor Matt. So the case is still open, and authorities hope at this point in when the episode aired that someone will come forward with a new lead. To date, the authorities' most substantial clue is still the Ford Explorer.
The thing is, if it's not supposed to be him, then there's, like, nothing to follow.
I know. Like, oh, I'm looking at the Unsolved Mysteries wiki. His little kid is so cute. Okay, is there any updates? No, it's still unsolved. Great.
Love it. Okay, I have a wanted to talk about.
All right.
On January 11th, 1995, a sheriff's van arrived at the Pasco County Courthouse in Dade City, Florida. It was transporting a 24-year-old murder suspect, Albert Leon Fletcher, and several other inmates. unbeknownst, which is a great word. Thank you, Robert Sack. Unbeknownst to the guards, Fletcher was able to pick the lock on his handcuffs and one leg shackle, which impressive. When the guard opened the back of the van, I love this reenactment too. So the guard like goes to the back of the van, opens it, and then Fletcher, like a spider monkey, has just been waiting to like pounce out, right? Okay, so he slams the door on him, jumps out. And he ran out onto Highway 98, wherever that is. Another guard fired at him, but missed. Work on that, I guess. After being nearly hit by a car, Fletcher fled down a creek and vanished into the nearby woods. Unsolved Mysteries calls Fletcher, quote, a felon with a violent criminal history dating back to age 15. Why that is his life, we never learn. What happened to this dude? Anyway, he was currently accused of armed robbery, armed burglary, grand theft, aggravated assault and battery, and murder. Impressively, wow. All of these charges stem from a single 24-hour period.
What?
Yep. It began on April Fool's Day, 1993. That night, him and his cousin, Douglas Porter, allegedly broke into a home in Dade City. They stole several guns, including a sawed-off shotgun. We see, okay, this part, I have to give Stack, remind me to give Stack a thumbs up just for this moment where we see him holding a shotgun and he says, the rampage was on. So silly. On April 2nd, at 2 p.m., two couples pull into the front of a grocery store in Lakeland, Florida. They're in their car, right? And then Fletcher and his cousin Porter pull right behind him. So of these two heterosexual couples, the women get out and enter the store, but Fletcher and Porter are dicks, and so they're like catcalling the ladies. Been like, you know, whatever. Lewd shit. And then one of the men in the car is like, you know, knock it off. So they get into like an argument with the two men that are in the car. They're like, could you please stop yelling lewd shit at our girlfriends? But Fletcher tells him to get his you-know-what back in the car. And this one guy, who I don't think his real name is David, he talks to Unsolved Mysteries and they call him David in quotes. It doesn't really matter. This guy becomes super pissed. And so that when Fletcher and Porter drove off, he goes after them, which not a good idea. I realize that you don't appreciate that this guy is just yelling shit at your girlfriend. I don't appreciate it either. But as we learned from that clam shack mystery, you should not angrily drive off after violent lunatics, okay?
So it's good advice.
Yes, that's as you get older, you sort of realize that you know nothing. That's part of the aging process. But I do feel like that is really solid advice that I can give you, to not angrily drive off after violent lunatics. So anyway, this guy, David, pulls up in the car and he tries to grab Fletcher. He's like hanging out of the window. And then Fletcher retaliates by pulling out a shotgun and like sticking it in David's eye and threatening to shoot him. And David pushes the gun out of his face. And fortunately, Fletcher and Porter drive off. So David and the other dude from the other couple are unharmed. They are like fucking lucky as hell.
Yeah.
They should have bought a lotto ticket that very night, because you're never going to be that lucky again. Okay. David believed, he says that like they were out to hurt people. Like they weren't just catcalling for the fun of it. Like they were like looking to get into violent fights with people.
Yeah.
And that he says that they acted as if they had no remorse about who was going to get hurt. So the next thing that they went and did, this is so bizarre. Okay, so it's now 11 p.m. and 16-year-old Jason Hartman is leaving his job at a pizza parlor, but he can't start his car. And then he looks up and at the driver's side window is Fletcher demanding the car. And when he's like, no. What? Fletcher pulls out a shotgun, at which point Jason, who's a fucking smart kid, he gets out of the car on the passenger side door, runs to the pizza parlor, is banging on the door that they need to let him in. He gets inside the pizza parlor fast enough that they can call the police. Hilariously, now Fletcher has the car, but it won't start. That's the reason the kid was in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. So Fletcher is there going, rah, rah. He can't get the car to start either. So he eventually gives up on it and flees with Porter. And Stack says, for the second time that night, they left behind a victim who knew he had just gotten very lucky.
Stack is like, this is some flowery language.
He's loving this. Yeah, thank God this kid who is, you know, just trying to sell losers pizza. No, you should be killing or robbing 16-year-olds that are just going to work.
Oh, yeah, leave them alone. Go find something else to do.
Yes.
There has to be a hobby.
Yes, for real. Join a book club. What are you doing? Quit harassing people. Okay, so then 2 hours later, they're driving along what is apparently a lonely stretch of highway. Isn't every stretch of highway? Outside of Lakeland, when they encounter a car driven by 32-year-old Nelson Olivares. Look, this guy's just trying to drive. So they start tailgating him. They're swerving erratically. They tell him to pull over. But then, of course, he's, of course, like, what? No. I'm not hanging out with you. They shoot out some of his car tires. They force his car off the road. They box him in within their car. And then they demand his wallet, which this guy, he apparently refused, and they shot him. Okay, I have to say, also, my other advice is if someone demands your wallet, just fucking give it to them.
Just give it to them. You can cancel your credit cards. It's fine.
I know it sucks. I know getting the DMV to give you a new driver's license, all that shit sucks. But you do not want to get shot with a shotgun. Okay. Also, I wanted to add that Nelson had a pretty sweet mustache, but I feel bad that he died in this incident. So the universe said, don't name this one. That's out of respect for Nelson. Okay, while the police were at the scene of Nelson's death, another officer spotted Fletcher and Porter across town. He had pulled them over, because they're probably driving like dicks, and asked them to step out of the car. When he looked inside, he saw the shotgun and some shells. And they already had heard about Nelson's death, and they knew they were looking for someone with a shotgun and a rifle. They also later found Nelson's blood on the shotgun and the passenger side of Porter's car. So that's why Fletcher and Porter were arrested and charged with first-degree murder. They were scheduled to be tried separately. In 1994, Porter was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. That same year, Fletcher was convicted of armed burglary and sentenced to 17 years in prison. But that escape, we talked about that at the beginning, happened before his murder trial. So he had not been brought to trial for murder, and he hadn't been seen since. We hear from a cop who says that Fletcher is a sociopath and a person without a conscience. He does seem uniquely terrible. He also apparently had repeatedly told his relatives that he refused to be taken alive. Okay, that's the end of this document. Here's the results. Captured on the night of the broadcast. Woo, woo, woo. A viewer from Delaware recognized Fletcher as one of her neighbors, which, ugh, that's not great.
No.
Though, maybe he was just kind of a dick neighbor. Like, not violent or anything, but just, like, annoying. And she was like, oh, good. I get
to call and tell mysteries about this clown.
Yeah, that guy's always leaving his trash cans in the wrong place. Finally. However, several weeks passed before she was confident enough about her identification to contact the police. She wanted to be sure, yeah. I guess. Yeah,
that's fine.
That's fair. You don't want to be just calling the police on people willy-nilly. On April 29th, 1986, Delaware authorities contacted this county detective and told him they had a tipster on the whereabouts. He's blah, blah, blah. Why? I'm like, okay, this update is too detailed. I do not need to know about, like, every phone call needed to make an arrest. Okay, whatever. We're skipping on. He was living with a woman who was unaware of his true identity. He was using the alias Kevin Woodside. I don't know why that's funny to me. Kevin Woodside. I don't know. Sounds fake. Apparently, Fletcher himself had grown tired of life on the run. He told the detective that he was glad it was all over with, and he wanted to go back and face charges. Oh, that's interesting. In July 1996, he pled guilty to escape and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Then in 97, he was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison plus 35 years. He appealed this conviction, was granted a new trial, where he pled guilty and was sentenced to 40 years. So in August of 2011, he was released, actually, for serving 16 years. So
he's Fletcher, someone else's shitty neighbor now.
Fletcher, if you're out there, we like you, and you're a cool dude, and you should leave us alone. If you're listening, we don't.
I'm going to assume he turned his life around.
Okay. Yeah, he's reformed. Yeah, the prison system totally reforms people. So
more likely than not,
he's probably. Well, look, when they came to get him, he went, oh, I'm just glad it's over. Then, yeah, it sounds like he kind of grew up and is not just Pope. Violently fucking with people for no reason. All right. Now, okay,
one more, and it's weird.
Okay, longtime listeners may remember when we talked about nature's whimsy, which is the phenomenon of having a twin. I don't know how that's really a mystery. But then Unsolved Mysteries went back to that very shallow well, and they're like, what about the phenomena of not having a twin? This is like when nature's whimsy goes awry.
What about the phenomenon of not having a twin? That literally is the segment.
That's what this is. It's like, oh, you know, the first one was silly. It was like, oh, do twins have psychic connections? When one pulls their groin, does the other one hear it? That really was in it. That's just not, that's not me being a freak. That was a real example. But this one is like, what if you had that section psychic connection, but that twin was dead? And I was like, this is fucked up.
And we're using Elvis Presley as our narrative guide through the twinless twin mystery. And I have to apologize. I didn't really take good notes on this, so I'm relying on the Unsolved Mysteries wiki, and it's sparse. It's because as shallow as this well, the Unsolved Mysteries.
Because this is not a mystery. This is not a mystery. Not having a twin is not a mystery.
I guess, I mean, I understand if feeling like your twin that you never got to know, which I can imagine is very sad and traumatic. It's
very sad and very traumatic, but Unsolved Mysteries treats it in like the silliest way.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's not a mystery here. It's just sad. That's not a mystery. It just fucking sucks.
It does suck. And you can believe if believing that they're your guardian angel brings you comfort, I think there's nothing wrong with that. But we're dedicating a whole segment on primetime TV to the twinless twin.
They really just wanted to put that footage of Elvis that they paid for in the commercial, and that's literally all that this is.
I think so. And heads up, we got another Elvis mystery coming sometime in the future, because when I was trying to find the Unsolved Mysteries wiki for this, I found two. So,
look, I kind of miss when conspiracy theories were more about Elvis, which in the 90s they totally were.
They used to be fun.
That Elvis was still alive, and he hadn't died on the toilet like we all thought. He was out there in like a trailer park, incognito somewhere, just hanging out because fame got to be too much for him. And people would be like, I saw, people would like send in Elvis sightings because people couldn't just like deal with the fact that he was a pill addict and he died at 44.
Right.
How shocking is that? Like when we talk about old Elvis, fat Elvis, he was 44.
I know.
He was an old man at 44.
Well, he had a rough life. It ages you quick. So if you didn't know, Elvis was what they call a twinless twin. His twin was actually born before him, but did not survive. His twin was named Jesse Garon Presley, and the two of them were born in a shack in East Tupelo, Mississippi, on January 8th, 1935. Jesse was declared dead before Elvis was even born, so he never got to meet his twin outside of the womb. Many believe that Jesse was the force behind Elvis's creativity and self-destructive tendencies.
The way to just like take away any any of his success, but also any consequences of his actions, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not that he was like good performer and handsome and you know whatever. No, first of all, that's because he had a dead twin, but also it's not his fault that he was an addict and you know he had a lot of problems. That's not his fault either.
He was a twinless twin. If his twin had just been alive, at one point, Robert's dad talks about. Imagine you're watching Elvis Presley shake his hips on stage, but then suddenly there's two Elvises.
I think that's the silliest part. And it's ridiculous to think that just because he had a twin, his brother would have been interested in music. Like, I feel like a lot of times twins are kind of want to define themselves separately from their sibling. And so I feel like he would have wanted nothing to do with it. If Elvis was doing music, that guy was going to do football or horses, or he was going to do some other. He probably would have like never touched the instrument because he would want to be his own person. He would not want to be the second Elvis.
Right. So anyway, we're told that while growing up, Elvis apparently heard a mysterious voice that he believed was his dead brother, Jesse.
That's, mental illness, addiction. his conscience telling him stop having sex with underage girls. I don't know.
Interesting. So Dr. Peter Whitmer is who the aforementioned man who coined the term twinless twin. He's done research on twins, particularly twins separated by death. Most twinless twins believe, according to him, that the spirit of their deceased twins have been close to them, sometimes as a guardian angel. It was a different guy that coined it. There's two twin doctors in this segment. I think it was the other guy. That,
I didn't even notice that.
Dr. Raymond Brandt is the one that actually coined the term twinless twin.
There's so many professions that I didn't even consider I could go into. I mean,
be a twin researcher.
Yeah, that never occurred to me. I could become a twin doctor. Oh, I only study twins. It does kind of make you sound like a pervert.
A little bit. So we meet some of these twinless twins. First is the, quote, case of Shannon Seitz, who died when she and her sister Diana were born. Diana believes that her twin saved her life. So what happened was she was driving along and there is a truck coming up behind her, kind of driving erratically. And she heard a voice in her head tell her to pull over. And she did. And the truck ended up sideswiping her. And she believes that if she had still been in the lane, the truck would have just plowed right into her and she could have died.
I mean, I personally would feel like that's maybe more instinct, that she was like, wow, this person is driving erratically. I should pull over. And then she did.
It was her guardian angel.
And then she went, oh, thank Christ I pulled over, because, yeah, that could have been a really bad accident. But if she was to believe it's her twin watching over her.
It's not going to harm anyone.
Yeah, it's fine. Do you think that she thinks her twin could have also been the next Elvis? It's a real question. How would her twin's music career have gone?
I'm gonna say great. Yeah, definitely.
Definitely.
So we're told that many twinless twins have an overwhelming sense of guilt because they believe that they caused their twin's death.
Oh God.
Which is,
I'm so sorry if you think that you did not.
I think Diana said that she was like, well, I was the one that survived, and like, maybe, like, you know, if we had been sisters and not twins, like, I don't know.
That's just,
it's not your fault. You're a baby.
The chance of the universe. That's not up to you. That's survivor's guilt. That sucks, though.
No. Robert Stack says that some say that Elvis's personal torment was caused by grief from his brother's death, believing he'd caused it.
I mean, maybe.
Elvis was never able to overcome the death of his brother, and some people believe that his brother's death may have eventually led to his death. So that the two could be reunited in the afterlife. I don't know. We hear from someone who knew Elvis and said that, you know, he often talked about his brother and talked about seeing his brother. He was religious and, you know, he talked to his mom about seeing his brother in the afterlife and how they'd all be together someday.
That's just so church. You know, that's just normal church, though.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he,
you'll see your family in the afterlife. Like,
I'm sure he did grieve his brother and probably never resolved that in a healthy way. But to say that like drove him to his own death is a little bold.
Samantha, men would rather have an extremely successful recording career than go to therapy. Don't you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Unsolved Mysteries Wiki closes with this hilarious sentence. To this day, nobody has any explanation of the twinless twin phenomenon.
Sometimes people don't have twins.
Amazing. I too am a twinless twin.
Yeah.
I have no twin.
I once got into an argument with someone over abortion rights, and they referred to themselves as an abortion survivor, which is essentially that their mom had given them up for adoption instead of having an abortion. And I was sort of like, bitch, me too. Like, we all are. All of our moms didn't abort us. That's why we're here.
Oh my God.
That doesn't make you special. I'm also an abortion survivor. By that logic, which is none.
Oh my God. People are the worst.
Okay. So we got to rate this now.
Okay. Mysteriousness?
Kind of mysterious. not the twin part.
The other ones, though, like who killed Matt?
And who killed Sue?
Yes.
And yeah.
Actually, these are very mysterious.
Thumbs up. Thumbs up for mysteries.
Thumbs up. Reenactments?
I thought pretty good, actually. I liked all the footage done at maybe not the same airport, but like at an airport to like show Sue's job and the harassment and whatever. I liked Fletcher popping out of the back of that van. Yeah, I'd say thumbs up.
I'll do a thumbs up on that one. I don't know about fashion. I was trying to think if anything stood out.
The only thing that I can really think of is that reenactment Sue's hair was amazing.
Oh, it was.
I love big
and actually, I really liked her in like her work outfit, like her work uniform with the hair. Yeah. It was a great look.
I don't think anything else stand out, so that'll just get us sideways. But reenactment, Sue, wherever you are, you were killing it.
Yeah.
And then Stack, I have to give him a thumbs up. He waxed very poetic, and he's standing in like a study wearing a trench coat, holding a shotgun, and saying like, let's get ready.
The rampage began.
Yeah, let's get ready to roll out. He should have cocked it and then acted like he was going to go on the rampage. That's the only thing that would have made it better, if he was like, let's roll. So thumbs up to him.
Yeah. Overall.
Okay, it's both silly because of the twin thing, but so sad.
Yeah, it's sad, and I really wish we had some solves in this one. Like,
yes.
Ugh, I don't know.
This is that meme where you watch a show called Unsolved Mysteries, and at the end it's unsolved, and you go, what? That's us, right? Or it's like, I wish these were solved.
Like, the Ice Woman one.
Oh, I almost forgot about the Ice Woman.
You know, I think people just survive hypothermia sometimes. I'm not sure that that's like all that miraculous.
She just got really good treatment, like it probably like the exact last moment that it could.
Yeah, I think she just had an intervention. I mean, you know, it was close, but you can survive.
It's very fortunate, but it's, you know, I don't know that that's that mysterious either.
So yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know. This is like a middle of the road episode, I feel like.
I'd say 3.5.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Where, okay, if you don't know, the scale is out of 5 Robert Stacks. Obviously 5 is the best. I'm going to give this 3.5 Robert Stacks.
I think that's solid 3.5.
Do you think that if Robert Stack had a twin, they would have both hosted Unsolved Mysteries in trench coats and they would have spoken unison?
The world is not ready for 2 Robert Stacks.
Which is what he was acting like Elvis's twin would have done. Just been like literally a mere copy of him and not his own person. It's like, here's Robert Stack and here's Ribbit Stack. I don't
know. Ribbit Stack. I'm just picturing a frog in a trench coat.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know who's naming their son Ribbit.
Ribbit Stack. Please make that the next coloring sheet.
Okay, our next coloring sheet has to be flag designs. But...
Oh yeah, you have to design your own flag. Well,
but after that,
March's coloring sheet is gonna be a Ribbit Stack, and it's a frog in a trench coat holding Unsolved Mysteries.
Here's the deformed twin of Robert Stack who somehow got turned into a frog.
He crawled out of the swamp.
So funny. Okay. I had an odd idea to do for my found love today.
Okay.
I'm going to do like a tip.
Oh, okay. You've already given us a few tips in this episode.
You know, I'm very knowledgeable.
You know, for example, do not angrily drive off after violent lunatics.
Yeah, it's important. It's good advice. Something a wizard or a scribe might tell you. Someone very wise. I was going to give I talked about years ago, I'd given tips on where to get frames on this show.
Oh.
And I was thinking I should give a tip on like hanging. If you're doing like a gallery wall.
Okay.
So obviously you can like measure shit out of where to hang things. But if you're like me, you hate math and numbers, and that's very annoying to like be like, oh, I want the center of this to be 12 inches from here, but the hanger is 3 down on the frame, but I want the eye level, you know, blah. This is what I would recommend. It doesn't work if you're hanging like 3 things in a row and you want them to line up. This isn't going to help you. But say you're doing a gallery wall or you're just putting like 1 thing somewhere. This is what you should do. You take your frame. You find the little hanger thing on the back. You put a dot of toothpaste on there. Then you go to the wall and you figure out where you want it and you press it against the wall just to leave a mark with the toothpaste. Put that nail in there, wipe the toothpaste away, hang it up. Done.
That's brilliant.
That's my tip for everyone. You're welcome.
Wow.
Incredible. When I when I go to hang up Archos, I literally bring toothpaste with me.
That's such a good tip.
So that I don't have to like measure. I can literally just eyeball it and go, this is where I want it. Pop. Done.
Amazing.
You're all welcome. And I guess if you had like very, very matte paint, like very matte white paint, maybe test it somewhere else first. But I've never had an issue with it like not wiping off.
Yeah, you know? I think it would. Yeah.
I could maybe see but usually wall paint is like a bit of a satin finish anyway. It has like a tiniest bit of gloss to it. So I don't think it should mark your walls. I've never had that issue. You just literally wipe it off and you're done. That's my tip.
I'm absolutely going to do that.
Okay. Did you have anything you wanted to talk about today?
I have a recommendation, a brief recommendation that relates to our most recent Patreon episode, which was Why Planes Go Down with Gillian Anderson. I use the app Flight Radar to see what planes are flying over me. Not because I'm like a plane nerd, although maybe I am now that I think about it. I just think it's really fun when I hear an airplane to pull up Flight Radar, which is a free app. I do think it kind of tries to trick you into purchasing it. And I think if you don't want the ads, you do have to pay like $4 a year or something. But you can just like not like skip it. I don't know when you download the app. But you can literally pull up the app on your phone and then see the planes that are flying around. You can click on them and see where they're going.
I do think this makes you the tiniest bit of a plane nerd.
I think it's fun. And I've noticed now that I've had the app for a while, maybe a year or more. I think I saw someone talking about it on Twitter back when it was Twitter. But it's just fun to like, I don't know, pull it up and see what's flying over and then be like, oh, you know, have a good trip. And they're like going to Paris or whatever. A lot of times, because I live in like a semi-rural area, I feel like you could be really busy because you're right by the airport.
Yeah.
If there's like a really loud plane flying over us, they're going to Amsterdam. There must be like a flight that regularly goes over us, because every time there's a really loud plane and I'm like, oh, I should see where they're going, and I pull up Flight Radar, click on it, they're always going to Amsterdam.
Okay, this makes we should take that flight. We should go to Amsterdam.
So now that you see my house from below.
Yes, that just seems cool. First of all, that just sounds fun. I've never been to Amsterdam. Who knows what kind of trouble we could get into there. But just the idea that you keep noticing, oh, this plane over me is going to Amsterdam. And then later we're like, you know what? We should go to Amsterdam.
We should be on that plane.
We should be on that plane, but in like a month.
Literally just last night, I was laying in bed and there was a super loud plane. I'm like, I wonder if they're going to Amsterdam. And I pulled it up and sure enough, they were going to Amsterdam. So I'm assuming it's just a big plane to make it that far. So that's why it's so loud. But there's also like several small airports by me. And every once in a while, there'll be like, I don't know, like a old, I don't know, vintage plane or something. Travis and I will like pull it up on Flight Radar to see what it is. Or like a helicopter. If you're curious, like, hey, there's a helicopter circling my house.
That I am curious about.
Yeah, or like I'm going to a protest and there's like a helicopter above me because they do nefarious shit with those things. You can like also like pull up, so it'll say like the like interesting flights, like the most like tracked flights in the world or whatever, and you can see like where they're going. I don't use that feature very often, but maybe you would.
Is this how you're gonna like take down the next Jeffrey Epstein? Is you're like, wait a second.
No, because you know what? You don't, like, not all flights are visible. Like, I think, like, you can't find, like, Taylor Swift's private plane, I don't think. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of, like, rich people don't.
Sure.
That information's, like, not available.
That makes
like, government sense. Stuff. Yeah. You're not going to see, like, you see some, but not, like, you know, probably top secret ones.
I can't just, like, start following around Beyonce.
Yeah, you're not going to see Air Force One. You know, like, all of the, like, Jeffrey Epstein's plane is not going to be on there, you know, or wouldn't have been on there.
Right, probably not.
But
that's interesting.
Also, if you, I don't know, like there's many different ways you can use like Google Flights and stuff if you're like having to pick someone up from the airport. So there's lots of different ways to track that. But you can use Flight Radar too if you know the flight number. You can put like my mom, I picked her up from the airport right after Christmas, and I used the app to track her plane. But it's the same as like using Google Flights or anything else. But you can use it for that too. So.
Do you think you're more into airplanes or trains now?
Mm.
Or is it too hard to choose because you love them all? You just love transportation.
I don't spend a lot of time thinking about trains, to be despite the fact that I went to two train museums in one day wearing a train sweatshirt and a sticker that said I love trains.
Even though we already have plans for next year for Spooky Train Day.
I don't really like flying. I'm not a particularly anxious flyer, like any more than I think is normal, but like I don't like flying. I'm not like going to airports and sitting with all the old men and watching planes take off.
It's amazing to me that there's like multiple people that want to do that. And I mean that in the nicest way. Like, I just like that they found each other and they can just like geek out about planes. And
it's a wholesome thing, you know?
Yeah.
That's what that dude should have been doing instead of going out terrorizing pizza boys.
Absolutely. Him and his cousin, almost his friend, him and his cousin needed to just find a wholesome plane spot, maybe raise some chickens.
Yeah.
You know, build
something. Flight Raider I've been around by then. At that point, he probably
fix up an old car. You know, you just need something enjoyable that pumps some dopamine into your brain. I think we're going to end it on that, everyone.
All right.
We'll see you in another fortnight. Bye. By which I mean you'll hear our voices. Goodbye.
Bye. Keep barking.
Keep barking.